Well, we're now in the DNA section of the course. For the rest of the term, we'll be dealing with DNA in one way or another. So, two units worth. And the first chapter of Unit 4, which we're starting right now, is about the cell cycle, which is all the stuff that happens within the lifetime of one cell, including cell division. And the opening slide here shows you three major functions or purposes of cell division. One of which, as you see, is reproduction. This applies to both unicellular and multicellular organisms. For a unicellular organism, cell division is reproduction. That's the whole process. It's a little bit different from how we produce it, because when a unicellular organism reproduces, it does not survive the process. Right? It ends its own life to split into two cells that now replace it. The original cell is no longer there. But cell division is also important for reproduction in multicellular organisms like us and plants and fungi. Because although we start out as one cell, we become multicellular because of cell division. You start out as a zygote, then you're two cells big, then four, then eight. A little later, you're 100 trillion cells big, roughly. Next up is growth and development, lumped together, even though there's a distinction. Growth refers to getting bigger. Well, that also actually applies to both unicellular and multicellular organisms, because when a cell, whether it's a unicellular organism or not, when a cell splits into two, of course, right after that happens, neither of the two cells is going to be as big as the one cell that just split into two, right? So even cells grow. But as we talked about in a previous unit, cells can't grow indefinitely big in all three dimensions. They're constrained by the surface area to volume ratio. So for multicellular organism, growth involves not a cell getting huge, but cells through cell division giving rise to more and more cells, which the multicellular organism's body is made out of. Development, just to distinguish that from growth, refers to changes along the way so that there is specialization of function by different kinds of cells. In other words, we're no longer not a single zygote, but we're also not just 100 trillion copies of the zygote, 100 trillion identical cells. We have different kinds of cells, nerve cells, muscle cells, and so on, that have gone down different trajectories, specializing in different functions. That's what development is. Third is tissue renewal. And here's one that does not apply to unicellular organisms, because unicellular organisms don't have tissues. Think back to when we were talking about the hierarchy of biological organization, all the way from atoms up to the biosphere. I told you that for unicellular organisms, they skip a few of those steps because the cell level and the organism level is the same thing for them. Well, they don't have tissues. Tissues are groups of cells specialized for a certain function. Applies only to multicellular organisms. But although we, in the normal course of living, lose billions of cells a day, just worn out cells that die naturally, we also every once in a while injure ourselves. And when we do, we are killing a certain number of cells wherever the injury occurs. And it's important for the cells in surrounding that area that do survive to get spurred into cell division to create new cells to replace the ones that were killed. That's an important part of the healing process. Okay, let's go on to two. We're looking at a cell here, but in the dichotomy of cell types, what kind of cell would you say this is? This is eukaryotic, And why do you say that? Right. This inner chamber where you see this dark purple stuff, thick stuff, that is a nucleus, and only eukaryotic cells have a nucleus. But even more specifically than that, I can tell by looking at this not only that it's a eukaryotic cell, but that it's a eukaryotic cell that is late in the cell cycle, meaning its life isn't going to last very much longer because it's getting ready to split into two new cells. And the reason I can tell that is by looking at the nucleus. In most of the time of a cell's lifetime, a eukaryotic cell's lifetime, if you were to look at it under a scope, you would see the nucleus, but you really wouldn't see anything in there. It would just be an even shade of gray or whatever in the nucleus. You wouldn't see these strand-like structures. Well, think about what's in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. What did I say is the material that's inside the nucleus when we were in the tour of the cell chapter?
DNA, right?
Well, DNA is part of the material, but DNA does not appear naked. DNA is complexed with a bunch of proteins. And what is that combination of DNA and proteins called? Genes are just parts of larger DNA molecules. And so the genes are there, but they are still just DNA. The mixture of DNA and proteins is called chromatin. And the proteins are called histone proteins. So chromatin is a mixture, DNA and histone proteins, complex together. And that's there the whole time the cell is alive. But what I'm trying to say is that for most of the cell's lifetime, before it gets to the point we're seeing here, that chromatin is loose. And so you don't see any clumping into rope-like structures like you see here. That's important because to do the jobs that DNA performs, which are, there's two of them, I'll get to in a second, to do either one of those two major jobs requires being able to read the code that's in DNA, which can only be done if the DNA is loose. If it's tightly wound up, it can't be read. And that's why for most of the lifetime of the cell, you wouldn't see what we're seeing here. That's why I know the cell's about ready to divide. Now back to this idea that there are two major functions of DNA. I actually don't remember whether back toward the beginning of the term I mentioned explicitly what the two major jobs of DNA are. Did I even say it? Yes, I did say it. So one of them is replication, which means making an exact copy of itself so that there are two copies of DNA. And that's really, of the two major functions, that's the function we're going to look at in this chapter, DNA replication. Now that's really important, speaking of cell division, because if a cell divides into two cells, if there's any hope for those two cells, so-called daughter cells, to be viable, in other words, to be able to survive, then each of them not only needs DNA, each of them needs all of the DNA that the original parent cell had. Can't survive with just half of your parent's DNA. So that means in order to divide successfully, a cell has to first make a second copy, an exact copy of its whole DNA library, so that each of the two cells can be given an entire library, one of the two copies. And so that's one major function of DNA, replication. There wouldn't be able to be cells giving rise to new cells without that. Do you remember what the second major function of DNA is? Exactly, transcription. which is just part one of a two-part process called gene expression. I first talked about this when we were looking at the various macromolecule types, and we got to a slide that was at the cusp between proteins and nucleic acids. That's when I mentioned gene expression. Gene expression refers to transcription first and then translation. But only one of those two processes involves DNA directly. DNA is transcribed, that's what transcription is, meaning the code is read so that an RNA molecule can be produced. That's now holding the code and DNA's job is done. And then RNA gets translated, which is the process in which the amino acids get assembled into a polypeptide. That's when the protein gets built. And so that transcription and translation we'll look at in the next chapter. But the transcription part of that gene expression process is the second major function of DNA. And notice that both of those functions require reading the code. That's why the chromatin has to be loose so you can get in there and actually read the sequence of nucleotides. When a cell, though, gets to the point in the cell cycle nearer the end of its own life so that it can split into two new cells, it needs to be able to manage this huge amount of chromatin without making a tangled mess. So it prepares for splitting by condensing the chromatin, coiling it up tightly. And we're seeing this start to happen here. It has much more condensing that it can undergo, because right now we can't tell how many individual pieces there are. Each individual double-stranded DNA is going to be part of one chromosome. One chromosome, as we call it, is a single DNA plus the proteins it's associated with. Well, it's no different material than the chromatin before you see it as a chromosome. It's just we don't use the word chromosome until it's condensed to the point that we see it as a separate entity. And that hasn't happened yet, but it's started. Okay? Let's take a look at a chromosome in slide 3. This is just one of several chromosomes in a eukaryotic cell. This, I think, is from a human, but it doesn't matter. Any given eukaryotic species has a certain number of chromosomes. For humans, it's a specific number. For other organisms, other species have more. Some species have fewer than humans. But whatever the species is, there's a certain number. This is just one of them, though, on the left. And that's a photomicrograph, so that's the real thing, not the cartoons in the middle. But it corresponds to this middle picture. And so we consider what's pictured here one chromosome, even though it is actually enough material to be two chromosomes, one for each of two cells that the cell will split into. But since the two identical copies, or at least the DNA part of this chromatin that makes up the chromosome, is identical, the two halves of this, each of which contains one DNA, are still connected to each other, and that's why we officially consider it to be one chromosome. But we specifically call it a replicated chromosome to indicate that it's actually enough to be two. It's just considered one as long as they're still connected. And the two identical halves of this, genetically identical, the proteins aren't necessarily identical, but the DNAs are. The two identical halves are each called chromatids. There's confusing terminology in this, so be careful. Chromatid and chromatin are just different by one letter. So this is one chromatid, this is another chromatid, and since they are identical and connected to each other, they're called sister chromatids. There's a lot of female usage of words here that has nothing to do with gender, it's just what we've named things. The particular place along the length at which these two sister chromatids are connected to each other is called the centromere. Okay, now, when we look at the cartoons, the top cell, and this is a sequence in time, this top cell's picture is really not the truth. What you see here on the top is one chromosome, but it's unreplicated. And the reason that this is kind of a lie is that you wouldn't actually see this. Remember I was saying earlier that the chromatin is loose until it starts clumping together, getting ready for dividing. Well, the replication, the job, the one major job of DNA, replication, that takes place while the chromatin is loose, like I said. And therefore, by the time the clumping occurs, the coiling up, the condensing, the chromosome is already replicated. You wouldn't see it. You would just see a... You wouldn't see anything here, really. The material would be there, but it wouldn't be as a chromosome. They just drew it as a chromosome to show you that it's only half the material compared to this one down here. So later on, after the DNA replication occurs, then you have replicated chromatin that condenses into something that we distinctly see, and that's when we start using the word chromosome. Made up of two identical sister chromatids. Then cell division occurs, and each of those two cells is given one of these two sister chromatids. But, just like we didn't start using the word chromosome, it's all just a word game, really, until we saw them as individual chunks. It's also a word game, so to speak, that we no longer call the sister chromatids chromatids as soon as they split. Once they split, they are chromosomes in their own right, but unreplicated chromosomes. And each one will be put into its own cell of the two that the one cell splits into. All right, that's the general scheme. Let's take a look at a cell cycle in slide 4. I say a cell cycle because you can go through this any number of times, but one time through this loop or this cycle is the lifetime of one cell. Now, of course, cells can be killed, so they don't have to make it all the way through. But assuming a cell does not get killed, one trip through the cell cycle is its own lifetime, but that lifetime began when a cell before it split into two, creating that cell. And then this cell will go through its own cell cycle, and if it survives, it will get to the end and split into two cells and continue. That's been going on for 4 billion years. We like to say that our life started on a certain date, but really, we're just a continuation of 4 billion years of cell cycles creating new cells. The outer ring here, the teal-colored one, plus the yellow, all of that combined is one cell cycle, but the cell cycle overall has two major subdivisions. And the first one, I say first because it happens first, but it also happens to be much longer, is, as you see, interphase. Following interphase is the much shorter mitotic phase, or just M phase for short. And you should be careful with this phrase because mitotic is just the adjective of mitosis. And confusingly, the mitotic phase includes mitosis. That's what it's named for. But it is not just mitosis. So the mitotic phase is not just another name for mitosis, is what I'm trying to say. The mitotic phase includes mitosis, but it also includes cytokinesis, as you see here. The mitotic phase, though, collectively, is eukaryotic cell division. So the cell is busy doing all of its interphase stuff that we'll talk about, and then it finally gets to the mitotic phase where it splits. Those are the two subdivisions of the overall cell cycle. Then each of those subdivisions is subdivided, as you can see here. So there are three parts of interphase. In order, they are G1, S, and G2. This is also kind of problematic naming because the G's here stand for gap. Gap 1, then S phase, then gap 2, so-called gap. It's a misnomer because gap kind of implies that there's nothing happening there. They called it that because when you look at a cell under a light microscope, you don't really see anything happening. There's nothing interesting to look at. But there's plenty of stuff happening in both G's. G1, by the way, is really the normal lifetime of whatever cell it is. It's busy being a liver cell or whatever. Just creating the proteins that it needs to do the job of living as that type of cell. And how does it create the proteins? Through gene expression. It has to go to its DNA library for the other purpose that DNA serves, which is transcription, and then it uses those RNA molecules, translates them into polypeptides to do the various functions of being that type of cell. That's what G1 is all about. The cell is not, well, no cell is thinking really, but the cell isn't concerned with how old it's getting, basically. It's just living its life in G1. But then eventually it will get to S, where it receives a signal to say it's time to go on to S. And the S phase is called that because it's short for synthesis, specifically DNA synthesis, meaning new DNA is created in the S phase, and that's the other major job of DNA. It was using DNA in G1 for transcription. In the S phase, it's using DNA for replication. And it will only do this if it's preparing to split, because that's the only time it needs that second copy of DNA so it can give it to one of its two cells. That happens in the S phase. That ends, DNA is already replicated, and so this is where I would say there's twice as much chromatin, but it's still just chromatin. You don't see it as chromosomes yet because it hasn't condensed. Then it enters G2, another so-called gap. Plenty of things going on here, but it's unlike G1 where it was busy being whatever kind of cell it is. Now it's busy in G2 preparing for the events of splitting. It's still transcribing DNA, and that's why it hasn't condensed yet, it's still loose. But it's now using genes that are coding directly for proteins that are going to be important for the purpose of cell division that comes next. Okay, that's interphase. Then you get to the mitotic phase, which is cell division. But think about a eukaryotic cell as far as splitting is concerned. Unlike a prokaryotic cell, a eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized, right? And you can think of two major compartments in a eukaryotic cell. There is the nucleoplasm, the stuff inside the nucleus, that's one major compartment. And there's everything else outside of that but still in the cell, which is collectively the cytoplasm. If a cell needs to split, a eukaryotic cell needs to split successfully, it needs to split both of these compartments successfully. So that's why for a eukaryotic cell, there are two major components to cell division, which are the two subphases of the mitotic phase. Those are mitosis and cytokinesis, as you see. Well, mitosis specifically refers to division of the nucleus and its contents. Cytokinesis is division of everything else, the cytoplasm, in other words. Both of these have to happen in order for one cell to become two completely independent cells. But of these two processes, division of the nucleus and division of the cytoplasm, one of them has to be much more carefully done than the other. So which one has to be more carefully done? mitosis. Division of the nucleus needs to be a much more careful process, right? You can't, in other words, say, oh, this looks roughly like half of the DNA. You take that and you take what's left over. Both cells have to get not only exactly half of the DNA, but they have to be identical copies. Each cell has to get the full library, not just half of the DNA in terms of mass. Has to be a whole library, and the other one gets a whole copy of the library as well. Mitosis is very careful, in other words. On the other hand, cytokinesis can basically be roughly, this looks like half of the cytoplasm, you take the rest. If something is missing in the cytoplasm, the cell can make more of it because it has the full genetic library because of the carefulness of mitosis. All right? They both, though, combine, mitosis and cytokinesis, both make up the mitotic phase. Well, look at the figure and notice that there are black lines between these phases like G1 and S or S and G2 and so on. But there is no black line between mitosis and cytokinesis. And in fact, it goes from yellow to another shade of yellow kind of gradually. What the artist meant by doing this is to convey the fact that mitosis does not end before cytokinesis begins. They overlap each other in time. Mitosis starts first, but before it ends, cytokinesis begins. And then it ends later. Once cytokinesis is done, you officially have two cells, and that is the beginning for each of these two new cells of one new cell cycle. All right, in 5 now we're going to look at mitosis, just part of the M phase, more closely. So mitosis is already a subdivision of a subdivision of the cell cycle, right? But mitosis itself then can be subdivided. And there are 5 phases of mitosis, even though we're looking at 6 pictures here. That's because this slide shows you more than just mitosis. Notice the first of these pictures is labeled as G2 of interphase. That's before the M phase. This is the end of interphase, right? Right before it gets to the M phase in the previous slide. We need to look at that so we can compare it, what's going on here, to what's going on in all the rest of them, which are mitosis officially. So the 5 phases of mitosis, as you can maybe read from where you are prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase, in that order. This last picture, by the way, is labeled as telophase and cytokinesis. So this is showing the overlap, basically. But telophase of mitosis and cytokinesis are separate processes, because telophase is part of mitosis, which is all about dividing the nucleus. Cytokinesis is about dividing the cytoplasm. Let's look at the condition of the cell in G2 of interphase, so before mitosis starts. Well, one thing is that these are photomicrographs on the top. They're colorized, of course, but they're real photographs. It's much better, though, to learn this by looking at the cartoons. And looking at the cartoons, I can tell that not only is this a eukaryotic cell, but it's specifically an animal cell. How do I know this is an animal cell? What about the centrosomes? Yes, it is, but what about the centrosomes?
It was their shape. I remember it was like we didn't know specifically what they did. But
we know what centrosomes do.
But like why they were there during the phase, right?
We don't take out the centrosomes. We take out the T, which are not the centrosomes. They're in the centrosomes. But what are the pieces that make up the T-shapes called? They're in the centrosomes. They are not the centrosomes. Centrioles, exactly. Those are what we don't know what do. But we know that animal cells have them in their centrosomes. So this whole slide is about how mitosis happens in an animal cell. Well, when I first talked about a centrosome, there was just one of those in the picture, in the tour of the cell picture. And that's because a cell, when it's first created, has just one centrosome. When it gets past G1 and enters the S phase, that, of course, is when the new DNA gets added by replication. But also during that S phase, out in the cytoplasm, the one centrosome gets duplicated. Which is why now, since we're at G2 after S has already occurred, there are two centrosomes. And notice they're right beside each other, each one with a centriole. Each one with a pair of centrioles in a T-shape. The nucleus, meanwhile, doesn't have anything in it that you can call chromosomes. The material is there, but we don't use the word chromosomes yet because we can't tell at all how many there are, right? But compare, if we did have a picture from even earlier in interphase, we could see that the chromatin that's in the nucleus is starting to condense a little bit. We're just starting to see some strands here. Very early, though. It's going to condense a lot more. And the nuclear envelope that defines the nucleus is fully intact at this point. Okay. Now let's go into officially mitosis, which has as its first subphase prophase. Well, we'll get to the nucleus, but let's look at what's happening in the cytoplasm. We have two centrosomes, as I said, because that got copied as well. But think back to what I told you the function of a centrosome is. I described it as a microtubule organizing center. That's what a centrosome is, meaning that microtubules get created by growing in length from centrosomes. And you can see that having happened a little bit already. So the two centrosomes are each creating microtubules that are coming from that centrosome, getting longer and longer. And notice that the microtubules from one centrosome are interfering with the microtubules from the other centrosome, which is causing the two centrosomes to push apart. In other words, they're polarizing. They're going to opposite poles, opposite ends of the cell. Now, they haven't fully polarized yet, but that polarization begins in prophase of mitosis. And what's forming here, it will get bigger and more complex, but this structure that's forming that consists of both centrosomes plus the microtubules that are growing from them is called the mitotic spindle. Mitotic because it's going to be involved in mitosis. And a spindle is something that is tapered at the ends and wider in the middle. Just like a football, basically, kind of what the shape is here. Now, meanwhile, in the nucleus, which is where the chromatin is, of course, we can see that there has been a lot more condensing of the chromatin. We still can't be sure how many individual chromosomes there are, but we can see that they're on their way to being called chromosomes. Not because anything is added or subtracted, it's just becoming more condensed. But importantly, in prophase, the nuclear envelope is still intact, so you still officially have two compartments. Now we go to prometaphase. Well, the spindle at this point is fully polarized because those microtubules have pushed on each other to the point of forcing the centrosomes to opposite ends. And these two poles, the two opposite ends of the cell, are going to eventually be the centers or the nuclei of two cells that this one cell will split into. So polarization is important. The spindle is made up of microtubules, and microtubules are all the same molecularly. But there are two functional categories of microtubules in the spindle. They're the same molecules, but they serve different purposes, in other words. And those two categories are kinetochore microtubules. Probably can't see the spelling from where you are. It's spelled thus. Kinetochore microtubules. And the other category can go by either of two names. One is simply non-kinetochore microtubules. Pretty self-explanatory. And that's what this book calls them. Other books call them polar microtubules. Here's the distinction. Non-kinetochore microtubules, which can be called polar microtubules, are the ones that we've already seen pushing on each other. And they are involved in polarizing the two centrosomes. Kinetochore microtubules serve a different function. They make a connection. They connect with replicated chromosomes. So we can see in prometaphase that there has been more extensive condensing of the chromatin. Now we can individually see chromosomes. These are officially chromosomes at this point because we can see them as separate. And if you look closely enough, I don't know whether you see it from there, but each chromosome is clearly a replicated chromosome, right? Consisting of two sister chromatids connected together at a centromere, like we talked about in the previous slides. Well, each centromere, there's one centromere per replicated chromosome. That's the connection point. But that connection point involves both of the two sister chromatids. And at that centromere position, each sister chromatid has a complex of proteins right there at that connection point called a kinetochore. And there's a kinetochore on one side, on that sister chromatid, there's a kinetochore on the other side. The kinetochores in this figure are the little black dots, two per replicated chromosome, one per sister chromatid, in other words. The kinetochore microtubules, which are the yellow things, part of the spindle, are called that because they connect, the end of the kinetochore microtubule connects to a kinetochore. Now, there are two kinetochores per replicated chromosome, but there's a kinetochore microtubule that connects to one kinetochore, and that's coming from one of the two centrosomes. And there's a kinetochore microtubule from the other centrosome connecting to the other kinetochore of that same replicated chromosome. You following all the terminology? It's kind of confusing. But you can see right here is a good view of two microtubules, one on associated with each of the two kinetochores, and those microtubules are growing from opposite poles. Those are the kinetochore microtubules. But notice that the chromosomes are in the nucleus, and the microtubules, which are part of the spindle, are out in the cytoplasm. So that presents a problem, because if you need to make a connection between a kinetochore microtubule and a chromosome, the nuclear envelope is in the way, right? It would prevent that from happening. That's why an important part of prometaphase is that the nuclear envelope disintegrates. It's no longer intact like it was earlier. You got to get it out of the way so that these kinetochore microtubules can make the connection with the kinetochores on the chromosomes. Also notice that these chromosomes are just found here and there, anywhere between the poles. There's no specific position for them. That's about to change, though. An important part of making both of these connections with the two kinetochore microtubules is so that after those connections are made, the chromosome can be moved in one direction or another, depending on where it is at the moment. That brings us to metaphase. Metaphase is the shortest in terms of time of the mitotic subphases, because it's just the short time during which all of the chromosomes, however many there are, and for this species it happens to be 6. For humans there would be 46 of these things, but for this species, whatever it is, there's 6. However many there are, though, during metaphase, all of the replicated chromosomes are moved to a halfway point between the two poles. Now, I don't want to say that they're lined up, which they look like they are in this figure, but this is a 2D image of a three-dimensional thing, right? If you think of this as a three-dimensional globe, they don't have to all be lined up. They just have to be anywhere in the plane that is halfway between the two poles. And that plane, that is not really a structure, it's just an imaginary mathematical plane, is called either the metaphase plate, which kind of implies that it's a structure, but it's not, or you can call it the equatorial plane. Either one of those is fine. So that's really the defining thing that makes it metaphase. They're all in that plate halfway between the two centrosomes. And they're not able to get there unless these connections are successfully made by the kinetochore microtubules earlier. Even though that's the defining character, another important thing has happened in metaphase that you can just kind of see here, which is that the condensing of the chromosomes is now maximized. They're a little bit smaller than they were in pro-metaphase because they're even more condensed. During metaphase, chromosomes are as small for that species as they will ever be. Maximal condensing. Okay, that brings us to anaphase. Notice up to now, up through metaphase, nothing has split apart yet. The splitting that is part of mitosis occurs in anaphase. Up to this point, what lined up at metaphase were replicated chromosomes, each consisting of two sister chromatids still stuck together. Those two sister chromatids during anaphase, two sister chromatids for each chromosome, that is, now split apart from each other. And this is where we change their name. They are no longer sister chromatids once they are on their own. When they're on their own, they're each called daughter chromosomes. They're a full chromosome, but they're just enough material for one cell, whereas a replicated chromosome that they were part of was enough for two cells. Not only do the two sister chromatids split, or the daughter chromosomes now, but those daughter chromosomes begin to move away from each other. Each one moves toward the pole associated with the microtubules that come from that pole that connected to it earlier. So keep in mind, these two daughter chromosomes that were together are identical. That's important because each cell is going to get a full copy of the whole DNA library this way. Not just half in terms of amount. It's one full copy and one full copy. Anaphase continues, meaning that the distance between the daughter chromosomes increases. They get closer and closer to the poles. And the last phase of mitosis is telophase. Not only do these daughter chromosomes reach their destination, the pole, which is really the position where a new nucleus is formed, but a new nucleus forms at each of the two poles. This is still one cell, technically, because cytokinesis hasn't completed yet, so it's still one bag of plasma, of cytoplasm, right? But for the moment, this one cell has two nuclei. And by a new nucleus, I mean that a new nuclear envelope forms around this collection of unreplicated daughter chromosomes. And then another one right here. But also notice that not only does a new nucleus form, even before the cell is done splitting, these daughter chromosomes are starting to uncoil to get looser so that they can start being read as genes for purpose of transcription. That's telophase, and that ends mitosis, which is just division of the nucleus. But In the same picture, we see the beginning of cytokinesis because they overlap in time. Cytokinesis has nothing to do with the nucleus, though. It's dividing the rest of the cell, the cytoplasm. And in animal cells, that happens by the formation of a cleavage furrow, which we see happening right here, but we get a bit better picture of it in the next slide, or in an upcoming slide. First, though, let's look at 6, which is just a much closer view for you of metaphase, and it's a much better job of looking at it, the 3D aspect of this. Now, this, what looks like a piece of glass, is misleading because, it's like I said, it's not a structure, but this is the metaphase plate. It's really just an imaginary plane, but it shows you what I was saying in words. The chromosomes don't have to line up. They can be anywhere in the plane, but that makes them halfway between the poles. And you get a much better view of the individual kinetochores, one per chromatid, and therefore two per replicated chromosome. One kinetochore will be connected to by kinetochore microtubules from one pole, the other by kinetochore microtubules from the other pole. Only if both of those connections are made will that replicated chromosome be able to be moved to the midway point. So those connections happen earlier, not in metaphase. Metaphase is when the chromosomes actually get moved to the halfway point. Slide 7. When we were learning this stuff originally, I shouldn't say we, I wasn't involved or born, but when scientists were learning this, they could see what was happening. They could see that these daughter chromosomes were moving toward the poles, and they could see that they were connected with kinetochore microtubules, but they didn't exactly know how they were moving. And there could be any number of hypotheses to explain it, but there are two major ones, both of which make sense. One of them could be more or less a fishing line hypothesis, meaning that a kinetochore microtubule is kind of like a fishing line with a hook at the end. It connects to the fish, and then you reel the fish in from the other end, and it drags the fish inward, right? Well, the fish here would be the chromosome, the daughter chromosome. That seems to make sense because it looks like what's happening when you look at it under a microscope. The other, though, is the more or less a roadway hypothesis, which is not reeling in the microtubule. The microtubule stays there, but serves as a little roadway along which the daughter chromosome moves toward the pole. And that makes sense because of what I've already told you about microtubules in general, right? They serve as little roadways along which things can be moved from one place in the cell to another. So these both actually make sense. Therefore, it's a good idea to set up an experiment to determine which of these is false. That's what this experiment was all about. And they used a molecular technique to mark the spindle at the kinetochore microtubules. It's, of course, not actually a felt marker making a black swath here, but it's really the same thing. They could see the mark. Well, if the fishing line hypothesis were true, then you would expect the distance between the mark and the chromosomes to stay the same, and you'd expect both the mark and the chromosomes to approach the pole, right? Because they'd be reeled in. On the other hand, if the roadway hypothesis were true, then you expect the mark to stay in place. It's part of the road, and you would see the chromosome approach the mark and eventually cross the mark. Well, that's exactly what happened, that second thing. You can see that in the results. So this was good indication that the fishing line hypothesis is not true. They're not being reeled in, the kinetochores, the microtubules, are not being reeled in. Instead, they are acting as roads. But the reason they look like they're being reeled in is because these roadways, these kinetochore microtubules, are unlike most roads. Most roads are there, put there more or less permanently to be reused. right? You don't use a road just once. Well, this is a road that only needs to ever be used one time. Because there's only one time that this daughter chromosome is going to make a trip toward that pole. Therefore, as soon as motor proteins, which are part of the kinetochore here, motor proteins just like ones we've already talked about that take one step at a time along the microtubules, as soon as they cross a part of the road behind them is no longer needed and therefore gets dismantled. So that's why it looks like it's being reeled in, but it's really not. All right, now eight. Let's talk a little bit more about cytokinesis in animal cells, which you're seeing on the left. This compares animals and plants. Mitosis happens basically the same way in both animals and plants, except that plants don't have centrioles, but all the rest of the stuff I talk about is true for plants. Cytokinesis happens differently, though. So let's look at more detail of animal cytokinesis on the left. The big difference between animals and plants with respect to cytokinesis is that animals, like any cells, have plasma membranes, but that's all they have as their exterior, right? A plant cell, in addition to its plasma membrane, has that very thick and much tougher cell wall. Animals don't have to deal with that. They have a flimsy balloon, basically, as their cell. And so cytokinesis in an animal cell is really just a cinching up, kind of like a drawstring or a belt. It really is identical to a belt, except most of us who wear belts wear a belt on the outside of the pants through belt loops, though, right? Here, the belt loops are on the inside of the plasma membrane, inside the cell. And then the belt itself is a ring of actin microfilament. Remember we talked about microfilaments being important in moving things, like shortening your cells in muscle cells and so on. So that's what this loop of microfilament is. That's the belt. And it, once the loop is completed, comes around back on itself and then starts to overlap more and more, just like a real belt does if you tighten it up. And that draws it inward because it's through these interior belt loops. That will continue, and it can continue because of the flimsiness of the plasma membrane. It'll continue until it actually pinches off, and then you officially, at that point, have two independent cells. Mitosis had already been done, so each of these two cells has a complete nucleus. And they're identical genetically to each other, and they're both genetically identical to the original cell that split. Well, a plant cell can't undergo this style of cytokinesis because of its tough cell wall. So what happens in a plant cell? Mitosis is already complete, as you see, two nuclei in this one cell. And this is turned 90 degrees compared to how we've looked at it before. So this vertical line between the two poles is the metaphase plate. And at the position of the metaphase plate, which is not actually a structure, some structures are forming, which are vesicles, as we see here. Well, you know that vesicles are little bags made out of membrane material containing something, right? And so each little vesicle, the exterior of that is made out of the same stuff that the plasma membrane is made out of. And in the interior of each vesicle contains the stuff that cell wall is made out of, which for plants is mostly cellulose, polysaccharide. These vesicles continue making more and more cellulose, so the vesicles are getting bigger, which means they are, as they expand, their edges are coming closer and closer to each other. And eventually, they will run into each other, meaning the membrane material that each one is made out of runs into each other and fuses because it's all membrane material. And that will give rise to this thing that is still fully inside the cell, but it's one long vesicle, basically, and it's called a cell plate. Well, it will continue getting even longer until its ends fuse with the opposite ends of the plasma membrane. And at that point, you have two official cells, because this plasma membrane here, which was the original, continues with this, which is now part of the plasma membrane. It was part of the cell plate, now it's part of the plasma membrane. And the same thing for the other one. That's cytokinesis in a plant cell. Slide 9, I don't want to spend much time on. It's the five subphases of mitosis, but this is occurring for a plant. Well, I've already told you that mitosis occurs in a plant the same way as an animal cell. I just want to show you that it's not just that we say this, it's actually visibly true. If you look at, you'll see these in reality when you look through microscopes in the lab eventually. But this is how mitosis looks in plant cells. You can clearly see the division, for instance, that happens in anaphase, the division of the daughter chromosomes and so on. The cell plate is forming too, but mitosis, there's no new information as far as mitosis is concerned from plants. It's just happening in cells that have walls. In 10, we're looking at cell division as it occurs in a non-eukaryote, in other words, a prokaryote. This one, it happens to be a bacterium, but for any given prokaryote, whether it's a bacterium or an archaean, cell division is simpler because they are not compartmentalized because they do not have a nucleus. And most cell division for prokaryotes occurs by a mechanism that we see here called binary fission. Binary simply means in two or involving two. Fission means division. A fissure is a split. Well, a prokaryotic cell does not have a nucleus by definition. But of course, it still has the DNA. It's just not in its own compartment. It has to have DNA for the same reason any cells, like our own cells, have to have DNA as a library for indirectly how to build proteins, right? Can't exist without the DNA. As far as chromosomes are concerned, there's a little bit of a difference between eukaryotic and prokaryotic organisms. Eukaryotic cells have some number, which depends on species, of chromosomes, and those chromosomes are linear, which means they have two ends. Prokaryotic organisms have one chromosome that is circular, or it would be if you spread it out. It's just one loop, doesn't have any ends. What looks like a blue spaghetti here is really one long loop. That's a single chromosome. So this is before the cell plans for cell division. Well, just like in a eukaryotic cell, cell division cannot happen successfully unless you first replicate the genome. The genome is just a name for all of the DNA. And so this one circular chromosome needs to be replicated. That's where we are in the middle picture, right before the split. There's twice as much stuff here because there's really two loops here, two identical chromosomes, because it went through, it's not called the S phase because it's not, this is happening in a different kind of cell that doesn't have a nucleus, but it's the same stuff is happening in as far as DNA replication is concerned. So once it has the two separate and identical circular chromosomes, then it can undergo binary fission, and one of the resulting cells gets one copy and the other one gets the other copy. Achieves the same thing, but it's a simpler process when you don't have to deal with having two chambers, two compartments. Well, we see that again at the top of 11. That's just the same picture we just looked at in 10, happening in a prokaryote represented by a bacterium. And on the bottom is a typical eukaryote, which is what we covered when we talked about mitosis in eukaryotes. But there's a couple other, because not all eukaryotes undergo mitosis identically. Plants and animals are the same, but plants and animals are only some of the eukaryotes. For instance, dinoflagellates, as we see here, a type of eukaryote, do not disintegrate their nuclear envelope. Instead, the nuclear envelope in these eukaryotes have holes in them through which the microtubules can extend, and therefore you don't have to get rid of the nuclear envelope. And in still other eukaryotes, diatoms, which are colorful things, colorful things you find in the ocean, major photosynthesizers, they don't have to disintegrate their nuclear envelope because they've solved this a different way. The centrosomes are actually inside the nucleus, so there is no reason to disintegrate the nuclear envelope. Despite those differences, though, the end result is the same. Mitosis always results in two genetically identical cells, genetically identical to each other and genetically identical to the original cell that splits. So mitosis and cytokinesis, they both have to happen in order to have two full cells. Because if you had, and this does happen in some cases, if you have only mitosis occurring but not cytokinesis, then now you have still one cell but with two nuclei. But for cell division, both parts, mitosis and cytokinesis to happen in a eukaryote, you form these two genetically identical offspring, these daughter cells. That's what eukaryotic cell division is for, creating new cells. That's how you became multicellular, by many rounds of mitosis and cytokinesis. That's the detail that I wanted you to know about these processes. In slide 12, we're talking about the control. So once you know what happens in the cell cycle, then a fundamental question is, well, how does the cell know where it is in the cell cycle? How does it know to go from G1 to S or any of the other places within the cell cycle? How is it controlled? How is the cell cycle controlled is the basic question. And before we knew, and we still don't completely know all the details of this, but before we knew anything about how the cell cycle was controlled, we made some guesses, some educated guesses, and it's reasonable to assume that there is some sort of chemical basis for the control of the cell cycle. In other words, there some sort of chemical probably is responsible for telling the cell, okay, you need to go to the next phase. But in science, you can't just say that because it makes sense. You have to demonstrate it. So that's what these experiments are all about, summarized in slide 12. In the first experiment, what they did was fuse a cell that's in S right now. Remember, that's the middle of interphase. That's when DNA replication occurs. S phase cell was fused to a G1 cell. So the G1 is before S. It's earlier in its own cell cycle. And when they did that, it's one cell now with two nuclei. But when they did that, the former G1 half of this cell immediately started replicating its DNA. In other words, it immediately went into the S phase. And that's a pretty good indication that there's probably some chemical involved, right? A chemical that the S cell has spurred the other half, which was in G1, to go right into S immediately. So it's somewhat convincing, but it's much more convincing what happened in experiment 2. Here they took an M phase, so this is at the end of the cell cycle, right? This is mitosis. And they fused that with a G1, which is at the opposite end. This is at the very beginning of the cell cycle. The M is at the very end. And so G1 is before S. It hasn't even replicated its genome yet. But when they fused the G1 with the M, the former G1 half immediately started trying to split its chromosomes into two daughter chromosomes. Well, it can't do that because it doesn't even have two chromatids yet, because it skipped right over S and went straight to M. So that is much more convincing evidence that there is some sort of chemical involved, some sort of chemical signaling that allows for control of the cell cycle. Doesn't it all, though, say what that chemical is or how it works? It just provides the basis, evidentiary basis, for there being a chemical basis for the cell cycle control. Well, speaking of control, in 13 we have what looks like a lamp timer. Nowadays, lamp timers are mostly electronic, but if you get the old mechanical type, they have those little pieces of red plastic that you put in there to set the time, you know what I'm talking about? And the whole thing moves like a clock, and when the little red piece of plastic that you put in there, it hits a certain lever in there, it turns the outlet either on or off, and whatever's plugged into it goes on or off. That's what these red things labeled as checkpoints are here, or what they look like to me. Checkpoints are important positions within the cell cycle, but physically what a checkpoint is a set of chemical conditions. Checkpoints, though, appear between major subphases of the cell cycle, like this G1 checkpoint between G1 and S. A checkpoint in everyday language is somewhere where you have to check in order to proceed, like at a gate, right? That's why they were named this. But as I said, they are just a certain set of chemical conditions. If those chemical conditions do not exist yet, then the cell will not proceed through the checkpoint. It will just stay in whatever phase it's in at the moment, G1, for instance. And that's what I meant earlier when I said G1 is the time spent being whatever kind of cell it is. It's not thinking about preparing to divide yet, because it doesn't have the chemical conditions in it that will tell it, okay, it's time to proceed through the checkpoint. So these checkpoints appear at important places, divisions between important ones, because the G1 checkpoint is particularly important, right? Because it says, okay, you're done living your life, you need to prepare to make two new cells. You don't want to do that unless it's proper to do that. And one example of when it's not proper to do that is known as cancer. That's what cancer is. Loss of control of the cell cycle, where cells think that they need to go through the checkpoint and divide when they really shouldn't be. You don't need new cells, nothing's been injured, but cells think they need to replicate, and they do this over and over, and that's why a tumor forms. So checkpoints are important for normal health, but that still doesn't tell you how they work. And in 14 doesn't tell you either, but the important thing about 14 is that these checkpoints, the G1 checkpoint, which is a particularly important one, like I said, can be met. I say met because it's a set of chemical conditions. Either those conditions exist or they don't. Well, they can be met easily or even not at all, depending on the type of cell. For instance, skin cells, we're losing millions every day. Just the wind blowing on you will release thousands of skin cells that are already dead at that point. You know, the layer of the skin that we touch is already dead cells. But if you didn't have living cells splitting into new living skin cells deeper in there to replace the dead ones that are lost, then we would quickly run out of skin. It would just go down to zero thickness. So we have to add new skin cells at the same rate that we lose dead skin cells. And since the skin is against us and the harsh environment, we lose a hell of a lot of them pretty easily. Therefore, skin cells don't have very long lives. They don't have a long cell cycle. they easily meet the G1 checkpoint so that they appropriately create new cells because since they're needed continuously. On the other hand, some cells, like a typical neuron, for instance, will stay in what is called G0, meaning it really is G1. It's just called G0 if that cell is never going to get to the checkpoint. So a typical neuron will last your entire lifetime or shorter. It will die. It can die, that individual neuron. You can still be alive. But it's not going to split into two new neurons under typical circumstances. So that's what G0 is all about. And the reason that this happens is because this control exists. If the control didn't exist, neither type of cell would know whether it's supposed to divide or not. And that would be a mess. Still doesn't say molecularly what's going on, and that's what's discussed in 15, but I'm not going to get into that yet. I'll save that for next time.